Have you ever said that? It's the wrong question, really, isn't it? We all have. I suppose the better question is, when did you last say that? Maybe said it this morning. Didn't know what socks to put on. Maybe last week. Maybe over a longer period of time, when some perplexing issue has troubled you and there hasn't been any obvious way through. You've shared it with your small group or your prayer triplet, and that's been good, and you prayed about it together, but the problem still hasn't gone away. Or maybe you've got impossible neighbours. Their home is like a madhouse with endless family rows at all hours of day and night, mum and dad yelling at each other, children out of control, the walls are paper thin, and you can hear the lot. It's very hard to live with, but how do you respond Christianly to neighbours like that? It's not easy to know. Well, then again, maybe you've been out of work for a while, but now you find to your delight that you have two job offers to choose between. One is highly paid, the other less so, but has other advantages, would give you more time in the week and at the weekend, and it's hard to choose. You think, what am I going to do? It may be something as trivial as not knowing what to wear at some social occasion, or the conflicting demands of the teenager, of homework and friends. Do I go out with the lads or do I stay at home to do the maths? I don't know what to do. Mum and dad may, by the way, but the teenager may not. One way or another, the question surfaces, doesn't it? Spoken or unspoken, what am I going to do? And that's the question asked by the farmer in this little story that Jesus tells in Luke chapter 12. Do turn to that if you've lost it, page 1049. That's his question, verse 16. The land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. Now Jesus tells us that he's a wealthy man, and without much effort on his part, he has become much wealthier. There's a touch of surprise here in his voice at this bumper harvest. So he's got a problem, not enough storage space. What am I going to do with all this extra wealth? And somebody might say, well, that's a problem I'd be quite happy with, actually. I'm more worried about not having enough for me and my family. But in his case, that's his problem. We note the furrowed brow, even maybe the wringing of hands and the pacing up and down the room as he wrestles with his dilemma. But before long, he has the answer. Light bulb moment. Knock down the barns and build bigger ones. Now, if he's able to do that without selling any of his extra crop, he must have a fair amount in the bank. So he is genuinely wealthy, this man. And his problem is solved in prospect, at any rate. And so we come to verse 18, I will do this, I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods, and I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years, relax, eat, drink, be merry. Enter many people's dream scenario. Imagine being able finally to relax. What a delicious word that is. Relax. Enjoy life with all the strains removed. Oh, if only, says this man's less fortunate neighbor, dream on. Maybe one day I'll be able to do that. Right now, life is not what I would call relax. One day, I'll be able to be like him. That reminds me of a retired couple that Sarah and I met late last year when we ourselves were returning from a rather special week away. This man and his wife, or more accurately really, this woman and her husband, because she did all the talking, they had found themselves in just such a position. They'd retired with more money than they knew what to do with, and certainly much more than they needed. So what on earth could they spend it on? And they came up with the answer, which was to have 6 foreign holidays a year, 2 weeks away each time. And that way they could solve their problem. It's what to do with all this extra money. That's what they decided, and of course it's their own money and perfectly entitled to do with it as they wish. But we didn't somehow get the impression that they really enjoyed all this travel. It's more elite. They were bored and didn't know what else to do with their time and their spare cash. And so this wealthy farmer in Jesus' story has solved his unexpected problem. And if he were alive today, of course, there would be so much more that he could spend this extra money on. I mean, just think of what money can buy these days. He could indulge in everything on his bucket list with the world's pleasures at his feet. And in 2019, if you've got enough money, you could even go to space travel. If you've the money to pay for it, it's there. So he's secure and he's comfortable, and he says to himself, I have ample resources laid up for many years. So eat, drink, and be merry. You can see its attraction. But if we do find our own hearts drawn to that picture and that lifestyle, and if we are tempted to envy it and to dream of it, even just a little, then Jesus says to us that we are already on very dangerous ground. Take care, he says, and be on your guard against all forms of greed and covetousness. For a person's life does not consist in the number of things that they have. Life is not about money, says Jesus, and about the things that money can buy. And covetousness, or greed, to use a simpler word, I suppose, represents a tremendous danger for the one who would follow Jesus. Jesus says, be on your guard, in verse 15. And it's a very strong phrase, because he is dead serious about this. This is dangerous territory. And the warning to be on our guard is provoked by this anonymous voice from the crowd. There he is, there's a crowd around him, as there usually was. And verse 13, someone in the crowd says to him, Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Which is an innocent enough request, as it happens. It seems that there's been a death in the family, and there's an inheritance, and the older brother has inherited whatever there was in the estate, and he's hogging it. He's sitting on the lot. And the younger brother wants his share. And we say, fair enough. But it's not what Jesus says when he's asked to sort it out. And his reply to the man is very direct. Verse 14, he said to him, Man, that's a fairly blunt way of addressing him. Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you? I guess he wasn't expecting that reply. But the point is that the older brother's behavior in sitting on the inheritance and not giving the younger one his share, it may well be unfair, but it's an unfair world. What do you expect? Life is unfair. It always will be unfair. And we don't have to live long in this world to discover as much. But being on the receiving end of unfairness is something you can probably live with. It won't wreck you in the longer term. So, maybe somebody once borrowed a lot of money from you, but it's pretty plain they have now no intention of paying it back. And that is going to hurt and make life difficult in a number of ways. But if that situation is rightly handled, your own character can remain unaffected and even grow in Christ-likeness through the experience, whereas greed has the ability to wreck you and to ruin you on the inside and for eternity. And that's why Jesus homes in, as he does, on this cry from the crowd. If there is injustice in this situation, well, with a bit of luck, there'll be somebody around who can sort it out. But it is not what Jesus has come to do. And his concern is much, much deeper than that particular issue. It's to do with the heart and with the whole direction of life. And that's why he says, take care, be on your guard against every kind of covetousness and greed. So let's take another look at this man and this delightful in its own way and very telling portrait. Just a few brush strokes and we can picture this man. It wouldn't be hard to produce a cartoon of this farmer from what Jesus says. What sort of man is he? Well, he's entirely self-absorbed, isn't he? Now, everything revolves around him. See the way he talks. He thinks to himself, verse 17, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. I will do this. I will tear down my barns, and I will store all my grain and my goods. It's me, everything revolves around him. There's no mention of anyone else. He may well have a wife, but if so, she's not the sort of wife he consults. There's no family conference here. There's no word with the neighbors who've got a bit of building work to cope with. He just talks to himself. He's entirely self-absorbed, no mention of anyone else, and certainly no fear of God. And that's his deepest problem. He's not dishonest. He's not a criminal. He's not a lawbreaker. All his plans are above board. There's nothing he can't justify. Tax inspector wouldn't have any problems. But he's bought into this age-old lie, the one that Jesus warns us against, and that our world is deaf to hearing, that life is about money and the things that money can buy. That is the lie that he has bought into. And his focus is entirely on himself and on this life, and without a thought for anything else, or anyone else, or anything bigger. And so he says quietly and complacently to himself, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. And we might be tempted to envy him. But God says, you're a fool. Because it is the fool, according to Psalm 14, who has said in his heart, there is no God. Well, he may not have said, there is no God. And in fact, in being a man of his time, he probably wouldn't have. He probably believed in God. He would have been found in church, or rather at the Passover meal, from time to time. But in the daily business of life, God wouldn't get a look in. That's the reality, after all. Why should he? I mean, what use is God to a man who already has everything he needs? And so his plans are drawn up, and necessary materials are ordered for his grand new design, and everything is ready to roll. And then the news gets out, and there's a hushed conversation down in the pub that evening. Have you heard about old Isaacson? No? What about Isaacson? He died, you know. Died? No. When? Oh, it's just this morning. Everybody's talking about it. Heart attack. Massive. Here one moment, gone the next. Really? Wow. What a shock. I mean, it was only last Friday that I played 18 holes of golf with him. Oh, you never know, do you, what's just around the corner? Oh, and by the way, did he leave a lot? Well, I don't know exactly, but I guess he left it all. Now, earlier in chapter 12, as we saw last Sunday, we read these words of Jesus, chapter 12, verse 4. I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body, and after that, have nothing more that they can do. In other words, why are you so afraid of people like that? All they can do is kill you. But, verse 5, I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who, after he has killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Now, what's the issue with the farmer? Well, it's just that he thinks his life is his own. There's no fear of God. He thinks he's not answerable to anyone. He's not accountable to anyone except himself. He's been talking to himself, never talks to anybody else. And little does he know that God all along has been listening in, eavesdropping on that private conversation between the farmer and his soul. It's an inner dialogue which God has been listening to. And then God says, with great sadness, I guess, fool, tonight your soul is required of you. It was only ever on loan from me, and the time has come to call in the loan. And in case we think he's a rare bird, Jesus tells us that there is no shortage of people whose aim in life is just like his. And we're to learn from the outcome of his life and the end of the story. This, says Jesus, is how it will be for anyone who travels down that road. And yet, wonderfully, there is a different way to live, of course, and an infinitely better one. And it's the way of the disciple. It's the way of the follower of Jesus, of the one who, in Jesus' own phrase here, is rich towards God. What a lovely phrase that is. And the teaching he gives his disciples in the rest of this passage today is very wonderful. It's very beautiful. It's very searching. It's very memorable all at the same time. And Matthew records very similar teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, which we looked at before Christmas. Now, because Jesus talks here about anxiety and worry and so on, we're quick to latch onto those words, because worry and anxiety and mental health issues are such great concerns in our day. But we mustn't go looking here for all the answers to contemporary questions, because Jesus' teaching here isn't really about worry and how we can be free from it. Christian life is not free from worry, and Jesus never says it will be. And after all, the rich farmer doesn't seem to have any worries at all. And that's his problem. He needs some. Now, this teaching is rather about priorities in life. And we are to get our priorities as clear and right as the rich farmer got them wrong. There's a lovely phrase in the Old Book of Common Prayer which speaks of Jesus Christ as the one whose service is perfect freedom. And so it is. As he said, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. But we won't experience it that way if our own thinking is not clear. And we need to remember, as Jesus warns us to remember, that life is not about accumulating money and the things that money can buy. It's not about building my empire. And of course, empires can be little ones as well as large ones. They just need me at the center. And to live like that is the route to relational bankruptcy. So if life isn't about that, what is it about? And Jesus has said shortly before, it's about relationships. He's asked, what is the great commandment in the law? And he says, to love the Lord your God with heart, soul, and mind, and strength, and that you love your neighbor as yourself. And that has to be the order. You cannot love your neighbor as you should if you don't love God first of all. And therefore, says Jesus in verse 22, since life is about loving God and loving your neighbor, don't let it become all about something else, about food and clothing and material things. They're necessary. They have their place. Of course they do. And your Father knows that you need them, but there's more to life than just living at that level. The farmer in the story was wealthy. The disciples whom Jesus is talking to, of course, were not. But the teaching is for them every bit as much as for the rich. It's to them who have very little that he speaks, because this principle applies across the board to those who have little, not just to those who have a lot. Now, without going into all the detail of these paragraphs from verse 22 to 34, which we don't have time for this morning, I want us just to notice two things of which the foolish farmer was totally unaware, but which the disciple of Jesus is not just to know, but to live by. Just two things. The first is this, that it is God's world that we live in. It's a very simple point, but it's very profound. It's not ours, nor does it have any existence of its own apart from him. He hasn't just wound it up like a machine and then let it run itself. No, he is intimately involved in what we might just think of as natural processes. There aren't any, really, in Bible thinking. He is intimately involved in all that goes on. It's a broken world, and a damaged world, and a world full of unfairness and injustice. But that does not alter the fact that it is a world saturated with the presence and the goodness of God. The one who made it has not abandoned it. So says Jesus, look at the birds, look at the ravens. They need to eat, they need to live and to feed their young, but they don't know how to plant a crop or harvest it. They can't build barns, they can't do any of it. So why haven't they all died? Why are there any birds left at all? Well, the birds are still around because God who made them looks after them, says Jesus. He feeds them. They spend a lot of time and energy looking for the food and bring it in, but they can't grow it or provide it for themselves. It's God who does that. He's there. He feeds what he has made. Then there are the flowers, lilies, in Jesus' words. And we just have to ask, can the finest fashion designer in the land come up with anything to beat the simple tulip, or the daffodil, or the cyclamen, the rose, for sheer unadorned beauty? Not according to Jesus. Even Solomon in his legendary glory couldn't compare with one of those. Crowds are flocking this month and next and beyond to see the exhibition in London of dresses by Christian Dior. It's the sort of exhibition of the century and his successors. And very impressive they are too. But I was down the road in Woodbury Park Cemetery earlier on this morning, just down the road there, and I was enjoying a better exhibition. Snowdrops everywhere. Beautiful in their simplicity. Where does the beauty come from? It comes from God, who Jesus says clothes those flowers in their incomparable finery. And all the created world speaks to us of his glory. It is his world that we live in. And if you know him as Father through Jesus the Son, you see it and you revel in it and you praise him for it. There's an old hymn which contains these words: heaven above is softer blue, earth around is richer green. Something lives in every hue that Christless eyes have never seen. So it is God's world that we live in, and the foolish farmer was blind to that. He thought it was his. And the other thing we find here is that this God, whose world it is your Father through Jesus Christ. Again, very simple, but very profound. He is your Father if you have come to Jesus the Son. And he is the creator of birds and flowers, but he is not their Father. And the point is very simple. If he lavishes such care on them, how much more will he care for you? I read last week that Crispin Odie, the well-known financial guru, is thought to be worth £700 million. He is worth £700 million. Funny, isn't it, how we talk like that? We measure people's worth by their bank balance. The Christian doesn't do that. Doesn't need to. Doesn't matter what my bank balance is. My value comes from what I'm worth to God. No bank balance can tell me that. He values most what he has made with the greatest care. And more than that, as a wise Christian of an earlier day said, my worth is what I'm worth to God. And that is a marvelous great deal, because Christ died for me, which we remember, of course, as we eat and drink in a few minutes' time in remembrance of him. So the logic is very simple, isn't it? Everyone does their best to look after what they value. And since nothing is more valuable to God the Father than his children, will he not look after you and provide what you need in this life? And so the question is, can you not trust him to do that? And will you not show that trust by aiming at a higher target in life than just going for the things that money can buy? All the nations of the world, says Jesus, seek after these things, and your Father knows that you need them, but you aim higher than that. Seek his kingdom. Make that your priority. Sit loose to your possessions and learn to give from what you have, whether it's much or little. And the other things that you need, well, God will make sure that you don't go short. Seek first his kingdom. Now, what does it mean to seek first his kingdom? Well, among other things, it means that the needs of the kingdom will have first claim on our income, on our resources, whether those are large or small. It's a simple fact that Christians begin to grow when they learn to give and to make their giving to God's work their first move rather than their last. Now, that's why the practice of tithing is one that many Christian disciples have found so helpful over the years. The practice of automatically giving to gospel work the first tenth of what I receive. It's true that though the tithing in that way is commanded in the Old Testament, it is not commanded in the New. It's not commanded of the Christian. There's no New Testament obligation to give 10%. Instead, we're called to be generous. But the principle of giving a proportion straight away and only then working out what to do with the rest is a very healthy one. And I would suggest it's a mark of anyone who is serious about their Christian discipleship. 10% may be too much for some, it may be too little for others. But putting gospel needs first in that very practical way, in the personal or the family budget, will, I think, be the mark of anyone who's committed to Jesus and the kingdom. And that may work out a bit differently at different stages of life. The younger person, for instance, with hopefully many years of Christian life left to live, might just be heard to say, well, I really can't afford to give anything at the moment. I'll start giving when I've got a bit more. That is invariably a mistake. And if you wait till you've got more to give, you may never start. Don't say, I'll do it when. Just do it. In the midlife years, with the demands of career and mortgage, and possibly of family, the danger may lie more in taking your eye off the ball, so that the needs of the kingdom are there somewhere in your thinking, but they've slipped down the list of priorities. It happens so easily, doesn't it? What Jesus elsewhere calls the cares of life can come in and throttle the word, and fruitfulness declines accordingly. You no longer look at people as you once did, with gospel eyes. Maybe you've lost that crystal clarity with which you once saw their need of Christ above everything else. And if that's so, then giving to gospel work seems somehow less important than it once did. It can happen so easily. It never, ever happened to Michael Green. Some of us will know the name of Michael Green, probably read his books. Michael Green was one of the finest Christian leaders of the past 100 years, a tremendous evangelist, and died very recently at the age of 88. He never took his eye off the ball. The kingdom was first from beginning to last. He ended his days in hospital. I gather he'd been speaking to a Christian union just 2 days before. He ended his days much as he'd lived them until that point. And if you happened to go and see him in hospital, there'd be no get-well cards or drinks or grapes on his bedside table. They'd all be pushed to one side, and instead you'd have found just a pile of Michael's evangelistic books, and on them a notice saying, if I'm unconscious, please take one anyway. Seek first the kingdom. And then the retired, or the nearly retired, can fall for the deceitful dream that so entranced the farmer in Jesus' story, that it's a time at last to relax and enjoy yourself because you deserve it. And you can step back now and let younger people get on with the work. You go and have your 6th foreign holidays a year or whatever and leave the gospel to others. And if that's the danger for you, then I commend this book by Jim Packer called Finishing Our Course with Joy. Jim must be 90 now, I think, and still going strong. This is a necessary wake-up call for anyone tempted to think on those lines. One way or another, Jesus urges everyone to take care, to be on your guard, not to lay up treasure for ourselves, but to be rich towards God. What a lovely phrase that is. And what does it mean? What does it look like to be rich towards God? Philip Ryken is a Christian from across the pond who puts it very well, and I close with these words from him. I am rich toward God when his glory is my highest goal, when his worship is my deepest joy, and when his fellowship is my greatest satisfaction. I am rich toward God when I offer all my abilities for his work without reserve. I am rich toward God when I take the time to serve people in need and give the first portion of everything I get to Christian ministry. I am rich toward God when I prioritize the needs of the poor and embrace a simple lifestyle that gives me more freedom for ministry. I am rich toward God when I decide there are some things I can live without so that I will have more to give to people who have not heard the gospel. I am rich toward God when I give and give until all I am and all I have is dedicated to his glory. Well, wise words. Do they sound good to you? I hope so. Let's pray together for a moment.